Okay, good afternoon. We'll make a start. Thank you all very much for coming. My name is Richard Reeves. I'm the director of Demos. I'm delighted to welcome you to this event. The first speaker you'll hear from is Richard Thaler, who is the co-author, along with Cass Sunstein, of a book called Nudge, Improving Decisions About Health, Wealth, and Happiness. I'm sure that you've all heard of Nudge. You may well have seen the current advertising campaign for the paperback edition, which is just out, published by Penguin in the UK. Have you been nudged yet? To which, after today's event, you will be able to answer, yes, I have been nudged by the nudger himself. Richard Thaler was over in the UK last year, and we had the opportunity to do some work together then. Professor Thaler is one of those people who is intelligent, influential, successful, and nice. In short, he's very, very difficult to like. However, we like him at Demos very, very much indeed, and we're delighted that he is here to talk about Nudge. And I should apologise to Richard and to his friends, co-authors, publishers and family for the title of this event. It's my idea to call it Nudgenomics, and I apologise unreservedly to everybody, and I'd like to assure you that was my idea and not Richard's idea. However, the reason that we came up with it was we're going to ask Richard not only to briefly outline his thesis, but briefly, because I'm sure many of you will be familiar with the contours of the thought, but then to talk a little bit about nudge and choice architecture in the context of financial services and the financial crisis. I'm then delighted that we have a respondent in the shape of John Kay, the influential economist himself and columnist for the Financial Times, who has his own book out, which is, I think, even more shocking colour than nudge.
It is shocking. I mean,
I've noticed that now the bestseller lists are essentially
it matches
based on
your
sort of
sweater.
Very, very bright colours.
Yeah, I think you win a copy.
Yeah.
Is that okay with you?
Yeah.
This is kind of nudging in action, giving other things. The long and short of it, finance and investment for normally intelligent people who are not in the industry. So that's also just that. John will be responding to Richard when he's done his contribution and then open to the floor. So, Richard, over to you.
Thank you, Richard. let me... start with a minute or two about the thesis of Nudge, and then go into one specific topic. So, the book is about what
Sorry.
We. Yeah. The book is about what we call libertarian paternalism or liberal paternalism on this side of the Atlantic, and. The idea is, can we devise policies that are good for people in the sense that they help people make choices that they themselves think are better? We don't claim to know what's best for people, but we're sort of trying to nudge people to make the choices they would make if they had the time and expertise to make a well-considered decision on their own. And can we do that? That's the paternalistic part. Can we do that without forcing anyone to do anything? That's the libertarian part. Now, I should hasten to say that it is not our claim that we can accomplish all social goals by nudging. We need to have rules against fraud. For example, we needed to do more than nudge Bernie Madoff. Obviously, we need laws against murder, drunk driving. We do need a nation of laws. But right now, I think we're at a point in our history where there's going to be a big debate as to what we've learned from the financial crisis and what should the response be. And it's clear that markets didn't work as well as we would have liked. many costs have been imposed on all of us. Our savings are worth half of what they used to be. There are many people unemployed. And there are going to be many in our society that think that the right solution is lots more regulation. And I think the right question to ask is, by whom and what will they do and what's the alternative? And how much can we accomplish with nudging? Now, the main tool of nudging is what we call choice architecture. A choice architect is anyone who is in charge of the environment in which we choose. So if we go to a restaurant, the chef decides what he's cooking that day, but there's someone in the restaurant who's in charge of making up the menu. And there are many seemingly irrelevant choices that the menu designer has to take. What order to display the items, how to group them. Should cold appetizers and hot appetizers be in separate categories? Should the items be listed in order of price or by some other criteria? What names should we give the various things? All of those are, according to standard economic theory, irrelevant. In the book, we coined the term econs for the imaginary creatures, otherwise known as Homo economicus, that populate economics textbooks, who are intensely rational, as smart as Larry Summers, or possibly even as smart as Larry Summers thinks he is, and who are unemotional and never suffer from self-control problems. So those are the people in economics textbooks. We behavioral economists think that we need to design policies for humans who have trouble with long division if they don't have a calculator and who occasionally wake up in the morning with a hangover. So the choice architect can influence humans, though they would have no influence on econs. Now, the book is full of things like the importance of default options, opt-in, opt-out sorts of policies that you've probably heard about. Today I thought I would stress one topic that plays a small part in the book but is playing a bigger part in my current thinking and in the current policy debate. And that's the role of disclosure and transparency, and how to use modern technology to facilitate better decision making. And let me illustrate this in two domains. The first is in consumer credit. What we want to argue is that for any product where the government currently requires disclosure. Take, for example, a credit card. When you apply for a credit card, you get many pages of fine print that no one ever reads. What we would require those firms to do is send you two electronic files once a year. One of those files would be data about your own personal usage. Now, this is data that you have every right to have. How did you use that card? How often did you buy things in euros and they charged you 2% conversion? How often did you pay your bill late and they charged you interest? So, and I'm explaining this with credit cards, but think of it for mobile calling plans or your checking account or your electricity bill. The idea is perfectly general. The second file would be, think of it as a spreadsheet that would list all the ways that your provider can charge you for things. So if you make a payment one day late and they charge you £20 and raise your interest rate by 200 basis points, that's in there. If they charge you 2% anytime you make a purchase in dollars, that's in there. Now, it's not that we think any humans would actually look at those files. Instead, what we think, and in fact, what we know, and I'll explain why we actually know this now. We said in the book, we now know that websites would emerge that would help you process those files. Now, the reason I know it is those websites already exist. And I'll tell you about one. I don't think it operates in the UK yet, but you can look at it if you want to get a sense of what the future could be. It's called billshrink.com, one word. And they operate in credit cards and cell phones. And now they operate, they can't do what we think. They don't have the power that we would like to give them. And the reason is they don't have these files. So the pricing data they have to get by the web term is scraping. They have to go to the website of the cell phone plan and get the pricing off of that and load that into their computer. The usage data, they can get one of two ways. They can either ask you to tick off how many text messages you send and how many emails you get, and the answer is you have no idea. Or you can give them permission to log on to your personal site with the provider. Needless to say, many people are unwilling to do that, especially for their credit card. They still, even with the system they now have, save people hundreds of dollars if they use them to pick the best calling plan or credit card. And it would work much better under the regime I'm talking about. Now, that's one domain. The last domain I want to talk about is the financial crisis. It is now technologically possible to require all financial disclosures by firms to be electronic. There's a language, a computer language called XBRL, that you can think about it as simply a way of, you ask for all the information, the equivalent of a form, like a tax form. And what that does is it gives each piece of information a tag. And then anybody can make use of that information in any way they want. Here's one simple example. The Bay Area Rapid Transit System, if you've ever been to San Francisco and taken the subways, they posted their schedule in a computer-readable form, and Google was able to massage that in such a way that you can put it on your cell phone. So you go to the station, and you click, and you find out when the next train is going to arrive. That will now be possible for every bus and subway everywhere in the world, as long as the providers give the Googles of the world the data in a raw way. Now, I think what we need is for the financial service companies to start doing this. I think we need to know the details of every mortgage in a mortgage-backed security. Here is the regulatory needle I think we need to thread. And don't push me too hard on exactly how we do it, because it's not easy. Somehow, we want firms to be required to release enough information so that regulators and the market can see what they're doing, but not so much information that they can no longer make any money. So, for example, a hedge fund, we can't expect that they're going to call us every time they make a trade, because nice one. Because, you know, if George Soros has to post all of his trades on a website, he's not going to be in business for very long. But I think it wouldn't be unreasonable to ask Soros to reveal his leverage ratio. And I think the other thing that is reasonable is the bigger you are, the more you have to reveal. So the byword I think we need is too big to fail is too big to hide. So anybody who creates systematic risk has to disclose more. That's going to be the tax for being too big to fail, is that you have to tell us what you're doing. And AIG should have been required to reveal their exposure via credit default swaps. I don't really mind if companies behave badly and go out of business, but I mind it if it costs us hundreds of billions of dollars or pounds to clean up their mess. All right, let me stop at that point. So
wasn't it available to the regulators, though? Didn't the regulators have that information?
No. Well, the rating agencies had access to more information than the rest of us, and they made a muck of it.
Yeah.
So essentially what I'm proposing is to let us all be rating agencies.
Yeah.
So let some 19-year-old geek figure out a way of processing the raw data and going into the business, instead of inventing Twitter, he can invent the next rating agency. Mm. And I think it'll probably be better than, well, that's not a big hurdle.
Yeah.
But it would be better than the ones we had this time.
Okay. If there are any 19-year-old geeks in the audience who would like to do that, then help yourself. Thanks very much for that, Richard, for kicking us off. I'm sure that you've already generated some questions in the audience. John, more information is power. Would that do it?
I'm not sure it will.
We're talking about whether we can find, through nudges, a solution to the global financial crisis. And I think many people in this audience will start from the position I do, which is to have be inclined to think that what the financial services industry needs is not a nudge, but a rather firm kick up the backside, or perhaps several of them. And that is indeed the conclusion which I'm going to come to. But having said that, I think it's important to say how large a contribution the kind of analysis that Richard and his colleague and others have been making to this kind of issue is. First of all, I think it's very important to say, as they do, that people's actions are the product of the context in which they operate. That it may seem unbelievable to most people that most economists predicate the work they do on the assumption that we enter the world with sort of fully formed preferences and rather elaborate calculating machines which then determine what we do. But that is indeed the world that most economists live in. It isn't, however, the world in which we operate. And in what was, I think, one of the most significant remarks of the blowing up of the current crisis, the famous comment when Chuck Prince of Citigroup said in the middle of 2007, so long as the music's playing, you've got to get up and dance, we're still dancing. What he really revealed was the extent to which, even if you occupy what is ostensibly the most important and prestigious financial services position in the world, chief executive of Citigroup, you're actually in large part a prisoner of your own particular context. So people's actions are the product of their context. Secondly, we can change that context. We can change what Richard describes as the choice architecture, and we can change that not just by the forms we describe, but by the institutions we set up. And that's rather clearly what we have got to do in the kind of reforms that the current crisis makes necessary. The third thing we learn from Nudge is the value of what is called liberal or libertarian paternalism. That's a way of saying that actually we can, there are areas in which we can leave people to make free choices, but nevertheless influence these free choices by the institutions we design for them. I think it's important for us to recognise what is the scope for us to do that and where that kind of way of going ahead isn't appropriate. It isn't appropriate, or it isn't necessarily appropriate, I think everyone agrees on this, where choices, the choices people make, are liable to have very deleterious effects on other people. So that's an area we take off the agenda. But then the scope for liberal paternalism is a sort of intermediate ground. It's an intermediate ground between the world in which government and the informed policymakers know very little about what's good for people, and therefore it's better if they leave them simply with freedom to make their own choices. That's one extreme where liberal paternalism isn't important or isn't useful. And the other extreme is the other end, at which we're not willing to respect bad choices, even if they're freely made by individuals in the context of the choice architecture which we describe. If I can give some examples of each, there's an area where government knows very little about what's good for people. For example, in the area of innovation, we all know that the media industries are evolving very rapidly. None of us have any sense, have any clear idea about how that industry is actually going to evolve and end up. And therefore, the best thing for government to do is to allow as wide a space as possible for people and businesses to make free choices, in the hope that the market process, by its usual mechanisms of trial and error, will come up with good outcomes as the technology and people's needs evolve. At the other end of the spectrum, we have areas like health and retirement savings, where even if people make what is to their mind an informed decision that they don't want to spend any money on their own health or their own retirement savings, we're not actually prepared to let them die or let them starve in retirement as a result of that. And that area turns out to go quite widely, even in the United States, for example. To go back to the financial services issue, we've taken the view for some time that we're not willing to respect informed choices for people to place their savings with financial institutions that turn out to go insolvent. That is, we provide, in effect, compulsory deposit insurance. The United States, as indeed does Britain, had a rather clear distinction between insured deposits and money market deposits that were very clearly not insured. But in reality, as soon as people with money market funds were in danger of losing their money in the recent crisis, the US government decided that it would protect people in money market for funds as well. So the area in which we're not willing to respect bad choices is actually quite extensive. But the scope of liberal paternalism is the area that lies in between. It's an area where we want to allow more scope for choice than we do in these areas like healthcare, where we're not prepared to respect bad choices, but it's an area in which we believe we know quite a bit about what good choices actually are. And I think the debate about the scope of liberal paternalism occupies a somewhat different ground in Europe to the United States. In the United States, a large part of the debate is about what is the area between the first and second, the area in which the government should be neutral relative to the area in which government should nudge people's choices, so that someone like Richard comes, as it were, on the left of that US debate. But in Europe, it's rather more to the right, where we're much more inclined to say government should actually make decisions on people's behalf. Now, how does all this relate to financial services? Well, I have to say, I think that most of what has gone wrong in financial services is covered by one of the three categories I've described. They're covered by the areas of choices, bad choices of bad effects on other people, and we shouldn't allow people freedom to make them. Or they fall into the area where government doesn't really know what it's doing and shouldn't get very heavily involved. Or they fall into the area when we're not willing to let people make bad choices anyway. And I think there's actually, in that sense, not very much scope for nudging in this area. And let me be more specific about what that actually means. I think we do, in the light of what we've been through and in the light of this kind of analysis, have to review our choice architecture. My view is that the primary focus of where we are is that we should separate what I've called utility banking from casino banking. That is, there is a bit of the banking system that we all need, which is the bit we use to pay our bills and receive our salaries, the bit that covers ordinary consumer credit and mortgage lending. And there's another bit of banking, which is the wholesale market activity, the securities trading, and the corporate advisory activities of banks, which incidentally is the area in which banks have lost all their money, including the money which we deposited with them. If you accept that description as the problem being the attachment of a utility to a casino, there are two ways of going ahead, looking ahead. One is to say we're going to regulate the casino so that in future no one will lose very much money in the casino. And I must say anyone who thinks that's an area, that a route that's going to work, doesn't understand very much about casinos and the kind of people who go to casinos. Or there's the route which I favour, the structural solution, which is in a basic sense a modification of the choice architecture, but it's an intrusive regulatory modification of the choice sector, which says that utility banks have to stick to narrow banking. That is, they have to be the rather boring institutions that banks in Britain and the United States were until the 1970s or so, and that's the structure which we need to restore. So that's the first issue, and it's not a nudge at all, it's a very firm tethering of particular choices. Secondly, is there scope for nudging consumer choices in relation to financial services? Well, I think there is quite a bit. But I think we also have to acknowledge that in that area, consumers don't very much like dealing with financial services, and they're actually rather bad at choosing. That means we need to give them quite a lot of help. But I think the main thing we need to do, and this comes back to reforming the structure of the financial services industry again, is we need to deal with these products, and the way in which we deal with these products in most markets where people don't really understand the details of the products that we buy, which is we rely on a mixture of regulation and the reputation of the product providers to ensure that people can buy products with reasonable confidence. You know, I don't know what goes on under the bonnet of my car. I don't want to know what goes on under the bonnet of my car. And in that respect, my attitude to my car is rather similar to that of the attitude of most consumers of financial services to financial services. And what enables me, nevertheless, to get in my car and drive it with confidence is a mixture of regulation that means that people can't put unsafe cars on the road in the first place, and the fact that I know the supplier of my car plans to stay around for quite a long time, and if he sells cars that don't work or are dangerous, he's going to damage that reputation. And the real problem we have in the financial services industry is that these financial services firms have behaved for some time with very little regard to the long-term maintenance of their reputation in the ways in which they serve customers. So I think what we need are fundamental structural solutions to the reform of the financial services industry that impose restrictions that take us back to narrow banking, that regulate and ensure more effective consumer protection of those firms that deal with small customers. And I would, frankly, limit regulation of wholesale financial markets to what is needed to kind of try and keep crooks out of it as far as possible. And otherwise, people can lose as much money in the casino as they like, so long as they're very clear that it's a casino they're going to go in where they play there. When they play there, is there a role for nudging in moving out of this global financial crisis? I think there is. But it's actually the biggest role for nudging, it seems to me, is in relation to the relationship between non-financial businesses and the financial services industry. That for the last two decades, ordinary businesses, businesses that make ordinary goods and services and are not engaged in the finance industry, have been unduly preoccupied with the financial services side of their activities. They've engaged extensively in mergers and acquisition. They've indulged in financial engineering. They've become obsessed with the share price. And they've gone into a dysfunctional process of earnings management and earnings guidance, by which a large part of the activity of the people who run these companies is devoted to managing the way in which they're regarded with the city. I hope that in the next, we're looking forward to two new decades in which the financial services side of the economy will be a lot less significant than it has been over the last 20 years. And I hope that a large part of that will be to nudge corporate managers into spending rather less time in the conference rooms of investment banks and rather more time in their factories and shops, worrying about customers and products and the kind of things that business is really about. And that's the biggest nudge which I would like to give people as a result of what we've learned out of this particular crisis.
Thank you, John. So you would presumably argue they're being nudged in the wrong direction at the moment. They are being nudged, but the structure of their they're being nudged the wrong way. Okay. I'm just going to give Richard a chance to briefly respond to that, but it's worth saying that Cass Sunstein, who's the co-author of the book, is currently awaiting congressional confirmation for a role within the Obama administration, so there will be at least kind of one nudger on the inside. And I was joking with Richard on the way Richard did a session with the Conservatives yesterday, is that as Richard kind of flies right across the globe, he also sort of seems to end up politically on the other end of the spectrum as well, because it's sort of Obama over there and Cameron over here, which is interesting in itself and shows that the kind of politics of this are quite hard to pin down. But do you want to respond to any of John's specific points?
I find myself sort of agreeing with the music of John's comments, but disagreeing with all of the conclusions. And so I'm not sure whether we've read the same book or he's read the book I wrote. So John, he has essentially three things where we don't want to do nudging. One is where there are externalities, so that my behavior affects Richard. I would say that's probably the biggest role for nudging. Take climate change. We're not going to prevent people from emitting carbon. We're not going to ban people from driving their cars or heating their homes. So how are we going to get them to change their behavior? Well, one of the tools is nudging. And we have a whole chapter on that in the book. They're very simple things that are very effective. Simply providing people on their monthly bills with how much energy they're using compared to their neighbor reduces consumption by 2%. Now, that may sound small and insignificant. That's what climate change is going to be. I mean, sure, we want to invent the car that goes 200 miles per gallon. But meanwhile, if for essentially a zero expenditure, costs nothing to put a little more information on the bill, if that can lower bills 2%, and we can think of 20 ideas like that, Why in the world wouldn't we do it? The second is when we're not willing to respect bad choices. Well, I don't know what the what domains John is thinking about, but in my opinion, prohibition was the biggest regulatory failure of the 20th century, and maybe the second biggest was drug programs. So if we don't want to prohibit fatty foods or cigarettes or alcohol, then we're going to respect people's right to make bad choices. And again, why wouldn't we want to nudge? The book starts with a hypothetical example of a school cafeteria in which the director discovers that she can get the kids to eat more apples and fewer biscuits by putting the apples in a more prominent display. That was a hypothetical example, but there have been experiments that have been run subsequently that show that, of course, the hypothetical example is very real. Again, why in the world wouldn't we try to nudge people to be healthier, along with all the other things we have to do? But I think my biggest difference of opinion with John is, well, let me start with what I agree with. The government is horrible at deciding what innovations to nudge. I can't agree with anything you said more than that. But why in the world then would we want to turn the banking sector over to the government? What a catastrophe that would be. We wouldn't, you know, we still wouldn't have credit cards. We certainly wouldn't have mobile phones. And in fact, the third world is a great example of what happens if you let the private sector compete with the government. There are no landlines in Africa and India. In India, to get a landline telephone, you have to bribe 4 bureaucrats. And so people just skip the bureaucrats and get a mobile phone. So we don't want the government to run the banks. And I've had two experiences recently. So I gave a talk on Monday at the cabinet office, and a talk 2 weeks ago to a group of career Treasury Department executives. And I asked the same question in both places. In Washington, I said, who in this room feels ready to take over Citicorp? And on Monday, I asked, who in this room feels ready to take over the Bank of Scotland? No one in Washington or London raised their hand. So, and thank God. Now, there's a great story. You mentioned Chuck Prince, his partner in crime, Bob Rubin, who is certainly one of the smartest government officials we've had in recent years, and one of the smartest businessmen. Owned up to the fact that he had never heard of a liquidity put, although Citicorp lost $50 billion selling liquidity puts. Now, so even Bob Rubin, maybe our best Treasury Secretary since Alexander Hamilton, wasn't capable of running Citicorp when he was vice chairman of Citicorp. The world has gotten very, very complicated. So that's why I come back to disclosure. I think that by requiring Citicorp to disclose more about what they're doing, including their exposure to the real estate market by selling liquidity puts, you're going to do two things. One, you're going to have the market helping out the regulators and as I say, replacing the rating agencies who failed us so badly. who were in the private sector, by the way, but sort of with a quasi-government blessing. And second, and kind of surprisingly, this is the insight I've had since writing the book, that by forcing that disclosure, you'll also allow the companies to operate better. That Bob Rubin will read in the newspaper how much risk he's taking, and he'll read about it in the newspaper before the stock price has declined by 98% rather than after.